Welcome to the Other Half of Church podcast, a podcast at the intersection of brain science, theology, and church life. With Michael Hendricks and Jim Wilder, we explore the brain God has given us and what we need for a healthy, transformational community of faith. Hello, and welcome to this special episode of the Other Half of Church podcast. I'm here with Jim Wilder and Michael Hendricks. And it has been about 6 to 8 months since the release of the book, The Other Half of Church. And it has been very encouraging just to hear the response and the feedback from readers and also from listeners of this podcast. We hope this has been a really helpful podcast to help you understand the intersection of brain science, theology, and church life. And today's episode, we are going to be talking through some of the reader and listener feedback on the topic, and have Jim and Michael both be able to answer those questions and dive a little bit deeper. It brings to mind a quote that I think is loosely attributed to Dallas Willard, but I can't seem to track it down. Your church is perfectly calibrated to get the results you are seeing. The things that are happening in your church are a result of the system that you have put into place. And so if we are seeing poor soil, poor discipleship, a lack of maturity and growth in our churches, we need to take a deeper look at the way that we do church. And one of the ways that that has been described recently to me is called the big evangelical machine. In your experience, how would you describe the big evangelical machine?
Well, that's a pretty wide category, so I'm always careful not to, I don't want to put everybody into the same bucket, but we do see some trends.
Right.
And, one of the trends I see, especially, when we understand the neuroscience of how our character grows and how we mature, and then we look at churches, I see some churches are almost built to keep people kind of at an infant level maturity. Paul talks about this too. It's not just our only generation, where he says, I could not give you solid food because you weren't ready. The author of Hebrews talks about the same thing. But it's all this kind of almost like this feed me attitude. Mm-hmm. This is really very much from the brain side of things. It's an infant level maturity, is to need to be fed, to need to be taken care of. It's very healthy for an infant. But when we start thinking, my church needs to feed me, or I'm going to go to a different church, I'm not being fed really well here. That's kind of a sign of this, and many, I think, evangelical churches, they're content to keep people at this stage. Their church grows numerically because they're being fed, but they're not growing in the more important way, the way that Jesus talked about, which is in our maturity and in our character. And Dallas Willard also said, would recommend people to ask, go to your leaders or your church and ask your church what's their, if they have a well thought out plan to grow your people to maturity. And there aren't many that even concern themselves with any effort. And even the ones that do, almost none of those bring the relational and the emotional maturity and character area into the picture. So this is very much the great omission. The evangelical church in general has lived out of the great omission, and because we really don't disciple our people.
Where do you think that idea came from? My church needs to feed me.
There's no doubt that we live in a consumer society, so the effect of our Western culture, which is, I'm looking for a product and I want it to make me feel good. So feed me is not very far from entertain me. It's not very far from, I want to have a powerful experience. Got to be a good, feeling when I walk away from this whole thing. And that really is all on the consumer end of things. It's not an expression of my character. It's not an expression of, how we're, how we're a part of any community. And in fact, probably going back to Second Great Awakening, the emphasis on getting people saved as sort of the end point of the Christian effort has kind of stayed with us, like, okay, once you're saved and we can get you lined up in the pew. And of course, being saved was all platform oriented. So I've heard it described as we need to move from the platform back to the table. Christian character is really built by the people we feed and the people that feed us. That's where attachment starts in the brain. It's like, you know, if you want to attach with a dog, you got to feed it. You know, you want to attach with your parakeet, you feed it. You want to attach with almost any creature, including human beings, it's this feeding. So they're right in saying I need to be fed, but what's missing is I also need to feed others. And being fed isn't from a platform. It's sort of the complaint I get from children in large families. They say, you know, well, my parents loved me, but I had 14 brothers and sisters, and you know, no one seemed to notice me individually. Well, how much worse if you got 14,000? You know, you're just going to be, you know, this kind of connection that where we know who we are and start to test what's coming out of us. You know, it's not what goes into a man that shows his character. It's what comes out of him, Jesus says. And so we need to be in an exchange kind of Christianity, not one that just flows one direction.
Jim, you said something about how we need to move from platform back to character. And I just find that so interesting because I work in the publishing space, and platform is a topic of conversation that we have to wrestle with so often, particularly when we are publishing books. That's something that matters, but we at Moody Publishers, we're trying really hard to make sure that platform is not the only tool that we're evaluating. It's not just how many books can we sell through this person and their platform, but is their character, is their message worth platforming and putting on a megaphone? How does the relationship between platform and character, how does that go together? Often the way to build a platform is to find an issue that's complex, turn your message into something that is overly simple, that demonizes the other side, and then just fight tooth and nail and you'll gain followers to simplify a complex issue. How have you seen in the church an emphasis, or maybe an overemphasis on platform, and how does that affect character?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in the other half of church, it really basically says we've been ignoring the relational and the emotional connection side of things. And those parts of ourselves really orient towards wanting to build a people and wanting to build a family, which is versus, you know, a lot of churches end up kind of becoming a spiritual organization that delivers spiritual content. But it's not really focused on, are we building a brand new people, a people that are learning how to live together in the kingdom of God on earth? You know, in the messiness of everything that's going on, you know, in our current land where we live, you know, it's not neat, it's not tidy. Are we interacting with each other? Are we interacting with Jesus in a way that he's telling us what it's like us to act here as a people and as a family? And that love is the factor that's before and after and above and below everything. That's the thing tying us together. It's the one thing that if we don't have it, God doesn't really want to listen to anything else, even if the other stuff's really good. You know, I always go back to Jesus' comments to the Ephesian church, you know, in the book of Revelation, where they're doing really good stuff. They're hard workers. They have good doctrine. They're not allowing false teachers to take over. And, you know, a lot of the other churches did, you know, so they're doing better than the other churches that Jesus talks to there. But he says, you've forgotten your first love, and I'm going to turn the lights out on your church if you don't repent. And that's a very, very, very sobering thing Jesus is saying. I mean, he preached the sermon on that, or taught the story that we're not supposed to put our light under a bowl. We're supposed to let it shine, you know, and from that rebuke that he delivers to the Ephesian church, he makes it clear that our main light that we shine is how much we love God and how much we love each other. And if we don't have that, there's nothing else to shine. If it's just truth and good doctrine and hard work and good completing a good vision with good strategies. But love isn't the first and foremost thing that people think of us. Like when someone says Christians, they think, oh, those people love each other so much. I don't know much about else about them, but man, do they love each other. I can't see a whole lot of people saying that about Christians right now in our current culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would add one other thing to that. And Michael, you and I have talked quite a bit about how the church is configured as an organization, and God really talks about creating a people, and the mechanisms for creating a people who belong to each other as compared to creating an organization are really quite different. But the mental models that society and culture provides have this huge impact on theology going across the whole history of basically starting with Scripture. When wheels first are invented, Ezekiel sees wheels, you know, whatever the symbols of the time are used to communicate the truths of God, which is important. But the flip side is we have a tendency then to begin to think in these models. So when we have the post-industrial world, which is built of all these big organizations, well, then in the back of our mind, the church must work like an organization. You know, it's got jobs to do. It's got things to do. That American business is all about, you know, vision. And so we think, and that's really what something like podcasts and platforms are very good at. They're good at spreading a vision. However, vision is particularly weak at forming character. It was one of the three items that Dallas mentioned, vision, intention, and means. But he said, you know, we've got to have the combination. Without a vision, you don't know where you're going. But if you don't participate, that's the intention part in it. And if you don't have a means, a plan that actually makes you work on and practice, I like what he said, for instance, about learning to return blessing for cursing. He said we should gather in groups, have one of our people in our fellowship group curse us, and then we answer with a blessing in return. You know, just practice that till you got it down. And those are the means by which you learn some of these things. But even those means by themselves don't turn us into a people. And the soil is the kind of things that help grow a people who have a sense of character, of relatedness with each other. So the problem is our cultural vision stops with the consumer part. We've got the platform, but does the platform lead to the relationship and becoming a people? That's the part that's been neglected.
Michael, what do you think happens when, if a church is all vision and no participation, as Jim has been talking about? What happens to the soil of that church?
That's a great question, Jeremy. And you know, that's one of the impetuses for writing the other half of church, is that this is what we see over and over again. And you know, if you've read the book, you know, there's soil needs to be constantly tended to if you want your plants to grow well. And you can't just assume or ignore the soil, because eventually then your plants are just not going to start. They're going to stop bearing fruit. And, you know, the four nutrients of soil we bring up in the book, you know, which is joy and hesed, which is our bonding, our love bonds, group identity, and healthy correction. They, you know, those are the things, you know, the first two is really what impels the growth of, you know, joy and hesed are really like fertilizer that just makes everything grow. And then group identity and correction are their nutrients in our relational soil that make sure we're growing the right thing, right? But when all those go low, then you just don't see much fruit at all. And then you start seeing all sorts of things going wrong. You know, we talk about platforms. You know, one of the things we see in depleted soil is that platforms also is really good at magnifying a personality. Like my social media platform, or the stage is a platform. And so too often in our churches, the great leader gets inflated. And we even think of the church as being his church. You know, we put his name on it. I go to Samuel's church or Fred's church, instead of almost more than Jesus's church. And this is very much a grave error that we're seeing today. And, you know, as a people, if we're operating as a people living in the kingdom of God, we should really be just disgusted, almost appalled by big personalities in a church, you know, because it's not just what we don't do. That's not who we are. You know, we're not a people who inflate each other. You know, the only person we lift up is Jesus. And, you know, because that's not how God's kingdom works, that we inflate a big person, you know, and we see things like that. A lot of times a church that has poor soil, relational soil as well, will be kind of the motivation, especially inside the staff. You may not see it just as an attender, but there's very much a fear-based motivation for things. Like, we need to do this or else, you know, when you're based on a lot of vision, like we have this vision and mission that we have to complete, then those vision and missions actually become more important than the relationships. And so relationships become sacrificed because the all-important ministry we're doing to complete our vision. And that whole thing is just set up to be a fear-bonded community, which keeps everything shallow, versus a love-bonded community. I think there's a lot of people in our country that have never, and a lot of Christians that have never experienced the joy and the completeness and satisfaction of a love-bonded people, having a church actually operate in that form. And all of discipleship really points towards love. You know, the ultimate goal of discipleship is that we love like Jesus loved, that we actually learn how to do that. And so if love isn't, you know, the central characteristic of our church, then something has gone wrong.
Yeah, it makes me think of a science experiment that I did when I was, I think, in middle school, actually, where we planted seeds in different types of soil and with different types of sunlight. And what surprised me was actually the plant that grew the fastest was the plant in poor sunlight. But it was because it was in almost like a desperate growth cycle to reach sunlight. And it's like, I kind of see a parallel too sometimes with different models of church, where it's like that when that vision is just for growth, you get the growth, but not the fruit of mature relationships. And it's like sometimes that vision of becoming a bigger church supersedes all of the other, I don't know, sometimes the things that you would think that the church should be about, of producing healthy disciples of Jesus. Is there a way to have a like really large church and still do discipleship well? Or are the two just like oil and water and can't mix?
Well, I believe there is a way to combine it, because if you're creating a people, that could be quite large.
Yeah.
The problem is that our models or our visions for doing it aren't conducive to creating that kind of encounter. Most of the churches, for instance, that are running these small groups, which became quite popular a decade or so ago, say they run really well for about 2 years until people's dirty laundry starts to come out. And as soon as something starts going wrong, the groups break apart. And you see character forms under those times that things aren't going well. So unless you can form some kind of connection with other people that's going to withstand a little something going wrong, you know, we're not going to be able to develop that. And besides, our vision of, you know, what we do in church really isn't related very strongly to forming relationships with each other. At best, we're forming relationships with Jesus kind of as a large pool of things. You know, that goes all the way up to the top. Back during the Vietnam War, one of the ways you could get out of Vietnam was by going to seminary. It was about the only way that you could escape it. And so quite a few people went to seminary, not so much because they were called to create a people, but because they didn't want to go to Vietnam. And when they did and graduated, they wanted to be viewed with the same kind of professional respect that the other professions were. So somewhere in that generation, being a minister and running a church became a profession. You run it like all other professions. You don't get too connected with people. You keep your professional distance. You have your professional persona. All of that grew the idea that pastors shouldn't really form friends. They shouldn't be connected. They shouldn't be relationally tied to the congregation. They should be like your dentist. You know, you can just swap them out anytime you need to, and you'll get same quality of professional care. So professionalism in church sort of infiltrated. Those people eventually became the leaders of many seminaries. And so now the vision that we're teaching pastors going in is, how do you become a really good professional, run a good organization, keep the standards high, get the production going? You see, all of those things running in the back of your mind don't help you say, you know, I need to love people when trouble happens. You know, I need to be let people into my character and help my character improve even as the leader. So those are the things that we're trying to reintroduce, and they're starting to feel kind of alien to the way that church has to be in order to make it work. And that's what we hear. Well, you know, yes, that's all very nice, but this needs to work. It needs to run. It needs to keep the numbers up. You know, those are the demands if you aren't getting that from your congregants, the people in your congregation, you're really not engaged with them, because all of culture, everyone that comes to your church expects you to be, you know, keeping the program up, keeping things going, making this thing run really well and have a good website and on and on and on.
Yeah, and it's interesting having your livelihood as a pastor tied to the size of the ministry, and maybe it's not even just your own livelihood, but the livelihood of other people in the organization. It's a precarious place for your soul. Just there's a lot of temptation in that to shift and alter and rub off the edges of things that you know will cause the numbers to go down, with what the Spirit is calling you to truly speak to the people. And sometimes that is uncomfortable. I do think that a lot of pastors are doing what they can to try and stay clear and true to what the Spirit is calling them. And then in many tragic stories, we find some leaders who we thought weren't. And so, Michael, I wonder, what do you think is the dividing line between those two end results as people are wrestling with their livelihoods and their spiritual life and the size of their church all being linked together in the decisions that they make? Why is it that some leaders can manage that and stay focused on becoming like Jesus, and for others, it just leads them to a terrible place?
Well, as we suspect very much that there's been in certain sectors, there's an outbreak of sort of a, you know, narcissistic leadership where you know, this is where the big personalities will come out to, and it's about me, and that I get to control the narrative and I get to be up in front of people and things like that. Although all of us, if we're honest, have some of that temptation, you know, when we get a chance to be in front of people with a microphone, you know, so that's always, there's problems with both of the examples that you mentioned. And again, it almost goes much deeper than that into why are we doing what we're doing, and what is Jesus actually calling us to do? And we almost never find, although they do exist, you seldom find churches that their primary purpose and driving motive is to be a spiritual family. You know, that we will be friends for life. We will live and die together. We will mourn and rejoice together. And there's, leaving our church is almost like having a child move to the other side of the country. You know, even if they're following what God wants them to do, it really hurts. You know, whereas, you know, some churches I've been in, people just kind of come and go, staff come and go, pastors come and go. It's very much like Jim said, it's like the dentist. You know, you just have to be good at your professional job, and then you get swapped out eventually. You know, maybe you self swap out because you have a career advancing move. Mm-hmm. And none of that is the way a family works. You know, if it's a healthy family, you know, my sister doesn't say, okay, I'm swapping you guys out, I've found a better family. You know, that should be as weird to us as it is in our church as it would be if that happened in our family. And, you know, one of the big missing holes or voids in our church too is just a lack of true eldership. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really talking about the office, what we think of as the office of elder that kind of tends to function like a board of directors or something, but I'm talking about men and women who are undeniably more mature than I am, further down the road, spiritually, relationally, emotionally. They have the ability to keep their heads in situations maybe where I might lose mine. And I get to actually see them do that. I get to see it with my own eyes. And, you know, elders tend to care very little for recognition. A lot of times you don't even know who they are, but they're essentially parenting the congregation. Mm-hmm. And even the pastors and the staff, many of the pastors need parenting. Mm-hmm. You know, just some basic maturity skills and someone who can come alongside. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, to grow our character, a lot of times we need to see it lived out, not just be taught it. Mm-hmm. You know, teaching it is not enough. We need to see other people living in a way we've never seen before, a loving better than we love that we've ever loved before, or even saw in our families. And we also need to hear their stories. Mm-hmm. You know, the stories of when, you know, when Jesus connected them in deep despair, when they made poor decisions and how they corrected it. You know, how did they get to this level of maturity? We need to hear those stories as well. And our brains actually track these stories, and our characters formed even by telling good stories as well as seeing it lived out. And then we need to practice it. Like Jim said, you know, the kind of exercise Jim mentioned where someone in a small group curses everyone and everyone blesses them back. We actually need that kind of reps. And that's very much missing in the current church as well, is the sense that there's part of church that needs to be almost like a gym workout. Mm-hmm. And, you know, honestly, there's probably a lot of people that don't want that. And so, you know, it can be a growth limiting factor, but I actually think there's a lot of people that do as well when they start feeling the inner fabric, emotional and relational fabric change because of these kinds of exercises by seeing more mature people live. Once they experience it in their bodies and see it, I think then it's almost like there's no going back.
You know, there's a tension on what you're saying there, Michael. On the one hand, we have to have enough joyful connection with somebody that we actually form an attachment that feels like we really want to stay together. And at the same time, there has to be this other sort of corrective. We're going to stay together, but we're going to actually show each other our weaknesses and the things that we don't do well. And we're going to kind of correct the ways in which culture, the devil, and the flesh have built us incorrectly as people. So unless we can kind of take some of that rough side, because we have enough good things going together, you know, we'll grow a people, but they'll be weird. They'll be a cult. They'll be something, you know, no one wants to be a part of ultimately. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, and again, in the middle of that, we have to have Jesus' direction and God's guidance of the whole thing, which would, you know, those are the three elements that we, you know, we think when you bring them together, you've got the joy and you've got the correction, but you've got God overseeing the whole thing. And when those things start to mix, very imperfect people start to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I've noticed is a lot of churches that I have gone to, when you talk about going to a small group, they have a small group that is built around your same age group or life experience. So it's like, here's the young 30s single small group. Or here is the parents with kids age 1 to 10 small group. And sometimes it's like, I want a small group with a bunch of people that have gray hair. I want to have a small group with some young 20s, because it's like, there are things that we can learn from each other and we can teach to each other, but that diversity sometimes is hard to bring people together with. It's like what we need and what we want are on two different ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true, Jeremy. It's you know, we're dividing, when we divide the church up into age groups like we have been, it's really kind of putting a ceiling on the amount of character change that can happen. Mm-hmm. There will be some, because even as peers, if we're just with our peers, we, you know, you're stronger than me in some areas. I may be more developed in other areas, and we can improve each other.
Mm-hmm.
But we still need the very obviously more mature men and women that show us how to do it. And we also need, it's also very important for us to have the less, you know, the newer people brand new to all this who are hungry and don't know how to do anything. Mm-hmm. And we need the peers as well. We need kind of that. But what a lot of, you know, sometimes it happens, but usually it's by accident in churches. And what it really needs, mm-hmm. is, especially in small groups, is to be intentional. If a church has some really strong elders, you know, very mature people, but they're all kept in the 60s and above, you know, activities or whatever your church does, you're kind of wasting a treasure. You know, you have a vault, mm-hmm. full of gold there, and it's just sitting there and it's getting dusty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the intentionality would be to how do we mix these people up so we get to see how each other, how we get them bonding together and loving each other, building joy together, so that this beautiful character and maturity is getting passed on. It's flowing between us in our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, the funny thing is the church tends to pass on the structure. So four generations ago, when we were deciding how church should look in North America, everyone was living with multi-generational communities and families, mm-hmm. in the house. And you were always with all the different age groups. You never had a chance to be with your peers. You went to church, it'd be really nice to just sit down with all the other people my age and have a moment. Mm-hmm. But now everyone lives separately, and we're still using a model that we think of as church-like, but it's four generations out of date. Now we need to be blending some people who never get to see each other in order to do this kind of growth. And so there's a way in which the church has to be constantly vibrantly reinventing itself. You know, the COVID situation, the online church, all those things call for us to reinvent ourselves, not in terms of what we believe or what kind of character we're forming, but just what do we need to do to correct for what culture and current events are doing to us to misshape the kind of people that God meant us to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about some of the reader feedback and the listener feedback that we have received. So there was an Amazon review that reads, "I came across this book because I was frustrated with what Dallas Willard called the persistent presence of untransformed believers in the church. Trying hard and following all of the rules simply does not get us to the place we want to live." And it's interesting to me that Dallas Willard pops up several times in the reviews on Amazon, because I know he has popped up a lot in our conversations and in the book as well. So maybe Jim and then Michael, if you want to explain, what was Dallas Willard's influence on your life, and how did it affect the development of this book?
Yeah, that's kind of a fun thing. Dallas, well, it starts with Dallas's wife, Jane, who actually was the one that persuaded him to start writing some of those books. But before he'd ever actually been writing anything, his wife was my first supervisor when I went to work in a counseling center. And so she said, "Well, I'd like to bring my husband in." She was the director of training, so she said, "I'd like to have him come in and talk to the staff." So Dallas came in and began to talk to the staff about what he called the care of souls, which he said originally was the providence of the church. But because the church has done such a poor job over the last 1,000 years or so, it's been moved to professionals. And so, he began to challenge the way that we did things. But in return, turnabout being fair play, we began to challenge some of the things he was teaching, in that they didn't work for people who had a lot of trauma in their lives. So the kind of practices that he was talking about, the spiritual disciplines and things like that, only worked intermittently. And so what we ended up finding, he and I discussed and finally in had a conference together in 2011 on what it meant to be spiritually and emotionally mature. And it turns out that people who have real trouble understanding how relationships work have trouble in their relationships with God and others. And people who are terribly content with the way their relationships work never stretch themselves to become better or different than they are. Dallas was working more on the people who are all too content with themselves. Mm-hmm. And we are working on the people who are so miserable with themselves, they never had a content moment. But mm-hmm. both cases, when you come down to it, were bad at forming relationships that endured well under strain, which is where character forms. So when you put the weak and the strong together, you actually have a chance of combining the elements that are needed to grow in maturity if you have God's presence in the middle of that. Otherwise, then who knows what will happen.
And Michael?
Yeah, for me, Dallas Willard, I was, you know, a pastor of spiritual formation discipleship at a large church, and I just found myself kind of bumping against the wall over and over again, and I started mm-hmm. reading Dallas Willard, and he was, you know, this was in after he had passed away, but he essentially was mentoring me, I felt, and encouraging me about what I was doing, because after a while, in our church, I kind of thought I was going crazy. It's like, you know, they don't seem to get what I'm doing, and it feels like I'm talking to a wall. And then I'd go out to lunch with Dallas Willard. You know, I'd literally go out to lunch alone, sit with one of his books and read it, and it was like he's speaking to me. And what was so important for me then is just the whole concept of the great omission. You know, that the church has been given this great commission to build the character, his character, into our people as in churches, and teach us how to love like he loved, and that the church is largely not doing that. You know, oftentimes it'll give lip service to discipleship, but when you actually look at where the rubber meets the road, there's not a whole lot is happening there. And that's what Dallas labeled the great omission. And, you know, I would read his books and think, oh, okay, so I'm not crazy. Thank you, God, for Dallas Willard. You know, I'd be going crazy here. But the one thing I found out was just like Jim said, I found limits to the effectiveness of spiritual disciplines, which were kind of Dallas's solution. You know, the main thing that's missing in the church. And I didn't know as much about the whole problem space as Jim did. All I knew is that these practices would sometimes work really well for some people and other times wouldn't work at all for them. And they would tend to work for certain kinds of people more than others. And so for me, it's just the results were so mixed. I thought I'm missing some of the pieces of the puzzle. This is part of the puzzle, but I'm missing some important pieces. And and that's when I met Jim Wilder, and he started explaining. You know, he said things like, you know, Michael, I think it would help you to understand a little bit about how the brain works to form character, you know, when you're talking about these frustrations. And no one had ever said anything like that before to me in my 30 years of Christian life and never in seminary. And so that was, you know, just a whole new wilderness opened up for me to be explored.
Right. And that is actually a great segue to another Amazon review that I personally enjoyed. Somebody wrote, Brain Science and Christian Community. This was a combination that I did not know existed. So I am with that person up until I started reading Rare Leadership by Jim and Marcus Warner, and then a bunch of other books that you guys have been working on. So Jim, if somebody is intrigued by the topic intersection of brain science and Christian community, what would you say would be a few books that they could get and read to get an introduction into this space? And please feel free to share other books that you have written as well.
Well, a lot of people are saying that the best introductory book is this, The Other Half of Church, and that breaking it down the way that Michael has is a really good place to start. There's Rare Leadership, which also published by Moody. And right now, another version is coming out in a couple of weeks by Northfield for helping Christians take this idea of building community into their workspace. So it's Rare Leadership in the Workspace. Northfield also has the book by Chris Corsi on the joy switch, which is a lot of how do you keep yourself in a relational kind of space. And then the book that, of course, has the dialogue between me and Dallas Willard, which is Renovated. So those are some of the good places to start. Book that Dallas recommended as the best book he's ever seen on the Christian community is Living from the Heart Jesus Gave You, which is sort of the fundamental book for the life model, which is how do you live as a Christian across your life, your entire lifespan at every age. Mm-hmm. And he used to use that as his textbook on Christian community when he would teach, of course, at Fuller Seminary and things like that. So we recommend that sort of the earliest book in the sequence. And all of these books also have exercises. Here's the thing. You can read all the books you want, but if you don't practice this stuff with people, it's not going to transform you at all.
That's such a good word, that head knowledge is not enough, that we have to get it into our bodies. And I think that's what has been so cool about talking with both of you, is that it's how do we bring these practices into the church, whether it's having a cursing practice at a small group, or how to demonstrate, like, how to really get the wisdom of the elders to be other people in the church. That's just such an important and new way of viewing discipleship, but rings very true to what you read in the New Testament. So the last thing that I wanted to do was, you guys have been hearing a lot of feedback and working in different small groups that are going through the content of this podcast and the content of the book. And what are some of the questions that you guys are getting in response to the book that may be helpful to talk to the whole audience about? Michael, how about you start?
Yeah, one of the common questions I get is about the whole issue of shame, and how can shame be good, and how isn't all shame satanic? And, you know, and then the nuance between toxic shame versus healthy shame, and that shame actually, when kept very relational and very loving, is absolutely essential part of character formation. And so people kind of want examples of that, and they want to hear, like, well, what's, you know, isn't this dangerous to even talk about this? And, you know, a lot of people that, like our group even too, say, well, can we use a different word? Let's not use the word shame. Let's use a different word, just because shame has such a stigma. And we also don't have very good kind of relational skills around shame, handling it and staying relational, et cetera. So it becomes scary. And so I think that's one of the bigger hurdles of the book. And I, you know, that's a hurdle Jim jumped in another book of his called The Pandora Problem. And I even kind of softened it some, but I'm still getting the same kind of reaction, like, oh, that one is really challenging me. And, but I think in a good way, most of the people that have said that, this thing, you've really made us think in ways we've never thought about before, in terms of shame, the role that the shame might even have a healthy role. Like, I'm not happy to be with you, so let's talk about this and remind ourselves who we are. That's really what healthy shame is. It's very much a reminder of what kind of people we are, and you might have forgotten that. And so let me remind you.
Can you give me an example of a healthy shame message? Let's say I guess you can give the example. I don't need to make up an example for you.
I was going to be very impressed if you could think up of an example at the top of your head. But let's say we're in a meeting. The three of us are in a meeting. All three of us work for Moody, and there's some big high pressure thing. And you say something that kind of I take as an insult, and I answer you back sharply and kind of shut you down in the meeting. Right? We go back to our offices, and you're in your office. Your head's kind of pounding, and you're angry, and you kind of want to avoid me. And healthy shame in that situation is you come out to my office and you say, "Hey, Michael, do you got a minute to talk?" And I say, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, back there, it kind of felt like you came at me with a lot of energy, and I felt like I was kind of insulted, and you were short with me. And I know you well, and I really appreciate our friendship. And that didn't seem like the real Michael back there, because that's not the way you normally are. And so, you know, first of all, I want to know, is there something going on, you know, in your life that I can help? And, mm-hmm. and just remind you, you know, the Michael I know, and I, and it's the people that we are, is that we're very, very, very slow to speak, and we're very quick to listen, and we're gentle. And so I just kind of wanted to remind you, who you really are, because you might've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is such a different way of processing shame.
Yeah. Very, very relational. You start with the relationship mm-hmm. first. You know, Jesus did that mm-hmm. as well. And some of the stories I share in the book, you know, mm-hmm. he's very relational, and yet he brought it, you know, he laid it on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so that process can be applied to so many different spaces, whether it's in the workplace or even my feeble attempts at parenting, trying to have a healthy shame message. If there's bad behavior from my kids, of like, this is not who you are. This is not what our group, our family identity is, and trying to help correct them that way. When so often you want to just lay on the toxic shame message, because it looks like it's effective, because you can feel the heat coming from it, but then there's negative consequences that come from that as well.
Or we just give them a pass and say nothing. Those are the two errors we make, right?
That's also tempting, yes. Like, let's just get this behind us.
And part of the problem with healthy shame is we have never practiced it. Like Jim said with mm-hmm. his, mm-hmm. you know, cursing and blessing exercises, he also came up with some interesting exercises where he created a bunch of hypothetical situations that happen. And he would say, you know, if we did this for 15 straight weeks, come up with a healthy shame message for me when I do this. And then he lays it out there. And we mm-hmm. break up into groups and wrestle with it, and then come back and tell it to each other, each of the groups. And, you know, that's the kind of work we need to do. Really, the only way you get comfortable is by doing it over and over again. And mm-hmm. starting with hypotheticals is very safe. And, mm-hmm. and so we're not so worried about our own, you know, exposing ourselves and vulnerability, but it helps us get used to actually how you do it.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, what are some of the feedback questions that you have received?
Well, people always push in two directions with me because, you know, they're kind of the other step beyond what Michael was just talking about. And the first is about narcissism. What do we do about narcissism in mm-hmm. leadership in ourselves? And narcissists are basically people who refuse to take a shame message. So mm-hmm. that's where it starts tying together. You can't tell them there's anything wrong without them turning you into the enemy. So it brings us back again to Dallas's main test of Christian character, and that is, do you love your enemies? Mm-hmm. And for most Christians, that's a benchmark that's ridiculous. It's like, oh yeah, well, I guess I still need to do, you know, to show some Christian growth. But what I've discovered to add to what Dallas was saying was that the only way that you get better at loving your enemies is by practicing it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that as a benchmark. Can you love your enemies? But if you never try practicing it, mm-hmm. you won't actually get better at it. Now, the thing was, when your brain goes into enemy mode, it has no intention or interest whatsoever in practicing loving your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So what you actually need is somebody else around you with more maturity that looks at you and gives you a good shame message. It says, you know, I know you're really mad at that driver who cut you off just now, but we're a people that love our enemies. So how are we going to show love to that driver who cut us off? And the angry person will say, well, I don't want to do that. They can go wreck their car for all I care. I hope they get, you know, and so but it's engagement in that moment and like, yeah, I really want to teach you this and we're going to get better at it. We're going to practice it. Those are the questions that people go to. It's like they say about the book, and actually Michael and I, we wrote the book with this intention mm-hmm. that it fills this middle space of showing us how we need to get there, but doesn't necessarily give us all the practices we need for some of the harder aspects of Christian character. But, you know, if we move, okay, so we're starting to give each other shame message. Will that actually help us with narcissists and our own narcissism? Well, yes, it will. Mm-hmm. Will it help us to love our enemies? Yes, it will. If we have a group identity, enough people around us who say, you know what, we just can't stay mad. We have to learn to love them. And what does that mean when we love our enemies? And let's work it out, because right now you're pretty mad at your wife. She's your enemy right at the moment. You're pretty mad at your son. He's your enemy at the moment. And, you know, we're Christians in the West. We're way too nice to admit that it's an enemy. But the point is, your brain is still treating them like one. So let's practice on these people where we've got that attachment. So it's the carry on of this book that people really want to start talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking it's very exciting if this other half of church started people talking about these topics, we'd actually get better because we'd start solving it together. So, you know, in some ways, we don't have to have a book that tells us all the solutions. We have to get together as a people and say, we really want to work on this. And it's amazing what will happen if people begin to work on solving how do we correct each other, how do we love each other, how do we respond with love to our enemies. You know, it becomes a community that is sort of resistant, wouldn't you say, Michael? Resistant to the growth of narcissism or to the growth of hate or to the growth of racism or to the, you know, these different things that grow in our midst that we look mm-hmm. back afterwards and say, however, we're going to get rid of that weed.
Yeah, that's the buy one, get one free we get when we improve our soil, is that it not only makes it good for flourishing character and fruit in that area, it kind of squeezes out the weed of narcissism. And so it's really, I mean, it's good all around.
Well, we hope that you all have enjoyed listening to this special episode of the Other Half of Church podcast. If you are able to, we would greatly appreciate if you were able to rate and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you haven't yet picked up the book, The Other Half of Church, it's available wherever you buy books. And we hope that you get the buy one, get one free of being able to grow in your spiritual life while also being able to be a blessing to others around you.